loved Sawley. If these stories were true, Sawley had denounced her not only for killing her father, but also for witchery. She had never spoken to the bishop about the allegations, nor had she demanded an explanation from Hilfred. Percy Braga was to blame for all of it. He had tricked everyone. Hilfred and Sawley had only done what they thought best for the sake of the kingdom. Still, she couldn't help wondering if perhaps she had been the one fooled. According to the church, witchery and magic of any kind were an abomination to the faith. If Sawley thought I was guilty, might he take steps against me? She considered it incredible that the bishop, who had been like a family member to her, who always seemed so kind and benevolent, could do such a thing. On the other hand, Braga had been her actual uncle, and after nearly 20 years of loyal service, he had murdered her father and tried to kill her and Ulrich as well. His desire for power knew no loyalties. She was increasingly aware of Hilfred's presence coming up the stairs behind her. Normally giving her a comfortable feeling of security, it now seemed threatening. Why is it he never looks at me? Perhaps she was wrong. Perhaps it wasn't guilt or dislike. Perhaps it was a matter of distancing himself. She had heard farmers who raised cows for milking often named them Bessie or Gertrude, but those same farmers never named beef cows, those destined for slaughter. Arista's mind began to race. Were they leading her to a locked cell in yet another tower? Would they execute her the way the church had executed Glenmorgan III? Would they burn her at the stake and later justify it as a purifying act for the crime of heresy? What would Ulrich do when he found out? Would he declare war on the church? If he did, all the other kingdoms would turn against him. He would have no choice but to accept the edict of the church. They reached a door, and the bishop asked Bernice to go and prepare the princess's room for her arrival. He asked Hilfred to wait outside while he led Arista in and closed the door behind her. It was a surprisingly small room, a tiny study with a cluttered desk and only a few chairs. Wall sconces revealed old thick books, parchments, seals, maps, and clerical vestments for various occasions. Two men waited inside. Seated behind the desk was the archbishop, an old man with white hair and wrinkled skin. He sat wrapped in a dark purple cassock, with an embroidered shoulder cape and a golden stole that hung around his neck like an untied scarf. He had a long and pallid face, made longer by his unkempt beard, which, when he was seated as he was, reached to the floor. Similarly, his eyebrows were whimsically bushy. On a high wooden seat, he sat bent in a hunched posture, giving the impression he was leaning forward with interest. Searching through the clutter was another much younger, thin little man with long fingers and darting eyes. He, too, was pale, as if he hadn't seen the sun in years. His long black hair, pulled back in a tight tail, gave him the stark and intense look of a man consumed by his work. "Your Holiness, Archbishop Gallion," Saldor said after they had entered, "may I introduce the Princess Arista Essendon of Melengar?"
"So pleased you could come,"
the old cleric told her. His mouth, which had lost many of its teeth, frequently sucked in his thin lips. His voice was windy, with a distinctive rasp.
"Please take a seat. I assume you had a rough day, bouncing around in the back of a carriage. Dreadful things, really. They tear up the roads and shake you to a frazzle. I hate getting in one. It feels like a coffin, and at my age you are wary of getting into boxes of any kind. But I suppose I must endure it for the sake of the future. A future I won't even see."
He unexpectedly winked at her.
"Can I offer you a drink? Wine, perhaps? Carlton, make yourself useful, you little vagabond, and get Her Highness a glass of Montemorcy.
The little man said nothing but moved rapidly to a chest in the corner. He pulled out a dark bottle from the contents and drew out a cork.
Sit down, Arista,
Salda whispered in her ear. The princess selected a red velvet chair in front of the desk and, brushing out her dress, sat down stiffly. She wasn't at ease, but made an effort to control her growing fear. Carlton presented her with a glass of red wine on an engraved silver platter. She considered that it might be drugged or even poisoned, but dismissed this notion as ridiculous.
Why poison or drug me? She thought. I already made the fatal error of blindly blundering into your web.
If Hilfred had defected to their side, she had only Bernice to protect her against the entire armed forces of Ghent. She was already at their mercy. Arista took the glass, nodded at Carlton, and sipped.
The wine is imported through the Van Don Spice Company in Delgos, the Archbishop told her. I've no idea where Montemorcy is, but they do make incredible wine. Don't you think?
I must apologize, Arista blurted out nervously. I was unaware I was coming directly here. I assumed I would have a chance to freshen up after the long trip. I'm generally more presentable. Perhaps I should retire and meet you tomorrow.
You look fine. You can't help it. Lovely young princesses are blessed that way. Bishop Soldor did the right thing bringing you here immediately. Even more than he knows.
Has something happened? Salder asked.
Word has come down.
He looked up and pointed at the ceiling.
Literally. That Louis Guy will be travelling with us.
The Sentinel?
Galleon nodded.
That might be good, don't you think? He'll bring a contingent of Sarette, won't he? And that will help maintain order.
I am certain that's the Patriarch's mind as well. I, however, know how the Sentinel works. He won't listen to me, and his methods are heavy-handed. But that's not what we are here to discuss.
He paused a moment, took a breath, and returned his attention to Arista.
Tell me, child, what do you know of Ezra Harden?
Arista's heart skipped a beat, but she said nothing. Bishop Soldor placed his hand on hers and smiled.
My dear, we already know that you visited him in Gutaria prison for months, and that he taught you what he could of his vile black magic. We also know that Ulrich freed him. Yet none of that matters now. What we need to know is where he is, and if he has contacted you since his release. You are the only person he knows who might trust him, and therefore the only one he might reach out to. So tell us, child, have you had any communication with him?
Is this why you brought me here? To help you locate an alleged criminal?
He is a criminal, Arista,
Galleon said.
Despite what he told you. He is.
How do you know what he told me? Did you eavesdrop on every word the man said?
We did,
he replied, passively. The blunt answer surprised her.
My dear girl, that old wizard told you a story. Much of it is actually true, only he left out a great deal.
She glanced at Solly, whose fatherly expression looked grim as he nodded his agreement.
Your Uncle Braga wasn't responsible for the murder of your father,
the Archbishop told her.
It was Ezra Harden.
That's absurd, she scoffed. He was in prison at the time and couldn't even send messages.
Ah, but he could and he did, through you. Why do you think he taught you to make the healing potion for your father?
Besides curing him of sickness, you mean?
Ezra Harden didn't care about Amrath. He didn't even care about you. The reality is, he needed your father dead. Your mistake was going to him, trusting him. Did you think he would be your friend?
Your sage old tutor like Arcadius?
Ezra Harden is no tame beast, no honourable gentleman. He is a demon, and he is dangerous. He used you to escape. From the moment you visited him, he calculated your use as a tool. To escape, he needed the ruling monarch to come and release him. Your father knew who and what he was, so he would never do it. But Ulrich, because of his ignorance, would. So, he needed your father dead. All Ezra Harden had to do was make the church believe your father was the heir. He knew it would cause us to act against him.
But why would the church want the heir dead? I don't understand.
We'll get to that in due time. But suffice it to say, his interest in you and your father got our attention. It was the healing potion Ezra Harden had you create that sealed your father's fate. It tainted his blood to appear as if he was a descendant of the Imperial bloodline. When Braga learned this, he followed what he thought was the Church's wishes and put plans in motion to remove Amrath and his children.
Are you saying that Braga was working for the Church when he had my father murdered?
Not directly, or officially, but Braga was devout in his beliefs. He acted rashly, not waiting for the Church bureaucracy, as he used to call it. Both the bishop and I speak for the whole Church when we tell you we are truly sorry for the tragedy that occurred. Still, you must understand, we didn't orchestrate it. It was the design of Ezra Harden that set the wheels of your father's fate in motion. He used the church just as he used you.
Arista glared at the archbishop, and then at Solly.
You knew about this?
The bishop nodded.
How could you allow Braga to kill my father? He was your friend.
I try to stop it, Solly told her. You must believe me when I tell you this. The moment the test was done, and your father implicated, I called for an emergency council of the church, but Braga couldn't be stopped. He refused to listen to me, and said I was wasting valuable time.
Fears of her own murder fled, and anger filled the vacuum. She stood up, fists clenched, her eyes filled with hate.
Arista, I know you are upset and have every right to be, but let me explain further.
The archbishop waited for her to sit down again.
What I am about to tell you is the most highly guarded secret of the Church of Nephron. This information is strictly reserved for top-ranking members of the clergy. I am trusting you with this information because we need your help, and I know you'll not extend it unless you understand why.
He took the glass of wine, sipped it, then leaned forward and spoke to Arista in a quiet tone.
In the last few years of the Empire, the Church uncovered a dark and twisted scheme whose goal was no less than to enslave all of humanity. The conspiracy led directly to the Emperor. Only the Church could save mankind. We killed the Emperor and tried to eliminate his bloodline, but the Emperor's son was aided by Ezra Harden. His heritage contains the power
to raise the demons of the past and once more bring humanity to the brink. For this reason, the Church has sought to find the heir and destroy the lineage whose existence is a knife at the throat of all of us. After so long, the heir might not even be aware of his power, or even who he is. But Ezra Harden knows. If that wizard finds the heir, he can use him as a weapon against us. No one will be safe.
The Archbishop looked at her carefully.
Ezra Harden was once part of the High Council. He was one of the key members in the effort to save the Empire from the conspirators, but at the last moment he betrayed the Church. Instead of a peaceful transition, he callously caused a civil war that destroyed the Empire. The Church cut off his hands and locked him away for nearly a millennium. What do you think he'll do if he has the chance to exact revenge? Whatever humanity he might have possessed died in Gutaria prison. What remains is a powerful demon bent on our destruction. Revenge for revenge's sake. He is mad with it. He is like a wildfire that will consume all if not stopped. As a princess of a kingdom, you must understand. Sacrifices must be made to ensure the future of the realm. We deeply regret the error that occurred in respect to your father, but hope you'll come to understand why it happened, accept our apologies, and help us prevent the end of all that we know. Ezra Harden is an incredibly intelligent madman, bent on destroying everyone. The heir is his weapon. If he finds him before we do, if we cannot prevent him from reawakening the horror we managed to put to sleep centuries ago, then all this city, your kingdom of Melengar, all of Apeladorn will be lost. We need your help, Arista. We need you to help us find Ezra Harden.
The door opened abruptly and a priest entered.
Your Grace, he said, out of breath, the sentinel is calling the Curia to order.
Gallian nodded and looked back at Arista.
What say you, my dear? Can you help us?
The princess looked at her hands. Too much was whirling in her head. Ezra Harden, Braga, Sawley, mysterious conspiracies, healing potions. The one image that remained steadfast was the memory of her father lying on his bed, his face pale, blood soaking the covers. It had taken so long to put the pain behind her, and now... Had Ezra Harden killed him? Had they?
I don't know, she muttered.
Can you at least tell us if he has contacted you since his escape?
I haven't seen or heard from Ezra Harden since before my father's death.
You understand, of course, the Archbishop told her, that be this as it may, you are the most likely person he would trust, and we would like you to consider working with us to find him. As ambassador of Melengar, you could travel between kingdoms and nations and never be suspected. I also understand that, right now, you may not be ready to make such a commitment, so I won't ask. But please consider it. The Church has let you down grievously. I only request that you give us a chance to redeem ourselves in your eyes.
Arista drained the rest of her wine and slowly nodded.
"Do you think she's telling the truth?"
the Archbishop asked him. There was a faint look of hope on his face, clouded by an overall expression of misery. There was a great deal of resistance in her. Saldo was still looking at the door Arista had exited.
Anger would be a more accurate word, but yes, I think she was telling the truth.
He didn't know what Galleon had expected. Had he thought Arista would embrace him with open arms after they admitted to killing her father? The whole idea was absurd. Desperate measures from a man sinking in quicksand.
It was worth it,
the Archbishop said without any conviction. Salder played with a loose thread on his sleeve, wishing he had taken the remainder of Bernice's bottle with him. He had never cared much for wine. More than anything, the tragedy of Braga's death was the loss of a great source of excellent brandy. The Archduke had really known his liquor. Galleon stared at him.
"You're quiet," the Archbishop said. "You think I was wrong, of course. You said so, didn't you? You were very vocal about it at our last meeting. You were watching her every move. You have that...
The old man waved his hand toward the door as if this would make his fumbling clearer.
"That old handmaid monitoring her every breath. Isn't that right? And if Ezra Harden had contacted her, we would have known, and they would be none the wiser. But now..."
The Archbishop threw up his hands, feigning disgust in a sarcastic imitation of Salder. Salder continued to fiddle with the thread, wrapping it around the end of his forefinger, winding it tighter and tighter.
"You're too arrogant for your own good," Galleon accused him defensively. "The man is an imperial wizard. What he is capable of is beyond your comprehension. For all we know, he might have been visiting her in the form of a butterfly in the garden, or a moth that entered her bedroom window each night. We had to be sure."
"A butterfly?" Saldo said, genuinely amazed.
"He's a wizard! Damn you! That's what they do!"
"I highly doubt—"
"The point is, we didn't know for sure."
"And we still don't. All I can say is I don't think she was lying, but Arista is a clever girl. Maribor knows she has proven that already."
Galleon lifted his empty wine glass.
"Carlton!"
The servant looked up.
"I'm sorry, Your Grace, but I can't say I know her well enough to offer much of an opinion."
"Good God, man! I'm not asking you about her. I want more wine, you fool!"
"Ah," Carlton said, and headed for the bottle, then pulled the cork out with a dull, hollow pop.
"The problem is that the Patriarch blames me for Ezra Harden's disappearance,"
Galleon continued. For the first time since Arista's departure, Salder leaned forward with interest.
"He's told you this?"
"That's just it. He's told me nothing. He only speaks to the Sentinels now. Luis Guy and that other one, Thranek. Guy is unpleasant, but Thranek..."
He trailed off, shaking his head and frowning.
"I've never met a sentinel."
"Consider yourself lucky. Although your luck, I think, is running out on that score. Guy spent all morning upstairs in a long meeting with the Patriarch."
He played with the empty glass, running his finger around the rim.
"He's in the council hall right now, giving his address to the Curia."
"Shouldn't we be there?"
"Yes,"
he said miserably, but made no effort to move.
"Your Grace?"
Salder asked.
"Yes, yes,"
he waved at him.
"Carlton, get me my cane."
Salder and the Archbishop entered to the sound of a man's booming voice. The Grand Council Chamber was a three-story circular room encompassing the entire width of the tower. It was lined in thin, ornate columns set in groups of two,
that represented the relationship between Navran, the defender of the faith, and Maribor, the god of man. Between each set was a tall, thin window, which provided the room with a complete panoramic view of the surrounding countryside. Seated in circular rows, radiating out from the centre, gathered the Curia, the College of Chief Clerics of the Nephron Church. The other 18 bishops were present to hear the words of the Patriarch, as spoken by Luis Guy. Sentinel Luis Guy, a tall, thin man with long black hair and disquieting eyes, stood in the centre of the room. He was sharp. That was Saldo's first impression of the man, clean, ordered, focused, both in manner and looks. His hair was very black, yet his skin was light, providing a striking contrast. His moustache was narrow, his beard short and severe, trimmed to a fine point. He dressed in the traditional red cassock, black cape, and black hood, with the symbol of the broken crown neatly embroidered on his chest. Not a hair or a pleat was out of place. He stood straight, his eyes not scanning the crowd, but glaring at them. "The Patriarch feels that Rufus has the strength to persuade the Trent nobles and the Church will deliver the rest. Remember, this isn't about picking the best horse. The Patriarch must choose the one that can win the race, and Rufus is the most likely candidate. He's a hero to the south and a native of the north. He has no visible ties to the Church. Crowning him emperor will immediately stifle a large segment of the population that might otherwise oppose us. While Rufus may not cause Trent and Calais to submit to the new empire, it should prevent them from uniting against us. In their hesitation, we shall find the time to consolidate the whole of Avron under one emperor. After which time, we shall systematically, one by one, force Trent, then Calais, to join or face invasion. Given the vastly superior wealth and power of Avron, it is more than likely they will submit without a fight. All the more so, with Rufus as emperor.
"You speak as if the unification is already complete," Bishop Tyldale of Dunmore said. "But Avron has 8 kingdoms, and only Dunmore, Ghent, and Warwick are imperialist. What about the Royalists? They aren't going to accept this without a fight. It's not like the time of Glenmorgan, when all he faced were a handful of warlords. These are kings with lands and titles that they've held for generations. The kingdoms of Ulburn and Melengar are old and proud realms. Even King Urith of Renyard, as poor as he is, will not simply take a knee to Rufus merely because we say so. And what about Meranon? Their fields supply most of Avron with the food we eat. If King Vincent resists, he could starve us into submission. And Galeanon? King Frederick has often threatened to cede to Calais, where he could be the strong leader of a weak pack rather than a weak leader of a strong one. If we insist on his giving up what little independence he has, we could lose him. I can assure you, King Frederick will bow before the imperial throne when the time comes," the Bishop of Galeanon announced. "And you needn't worry about Meranon's wheat fields," the Bishop of Meranon said. "As you can see, the Royalist problem has been eliminated," Guy assured them. "It has taken nearly a generation, but the Church has managed to successfully insert loyal imperialists in key positions in each kingdom, with the minor exception of Melengar, where our plans did not proceed as expected. This failure will easily be mitigated by its singularity. Once Rufus is declared emperor, all the other kingdoms will pledge allegiance, and Melengar will be alone. They will capitulate or face a war with the rest of Avron. So yes, with just a few minor issues, the unification of Avron has indeed already been accomplished. We just have not made this fact public." This caused a murmur throughout the chamber.
I knew we were progressing successfully on this project,
Soldo told the Archbishop,
but I had no idea we were so far along.
Braga's appointment as King of Malangar was to be the final step,
Galleon replied with a disappointed tone. Of all the kingdoms the Church had prepared for the coming new empire, only Soldo's had failed.
And the Nationalists?
The prelate of Ratibor asked.
They've been growing in number. You can't simply ignore them.
The Nationalists will be an issue, Guy admitted. For years now the Saret have been watching Gaunt and his followers. They are being funded by the Delor family and several other powerful merchant cartels in the Republic of Delgos. Delgos has enjoyed its freedom for too long to be convinced of the advantages of a central authority. They already fear the very idea of a unified empire, so yes, we know they will fight. They will need to be defeated on the battlefield, which is another reason why the Patriarch has selected Rufus. He's a ruthless warlord. He'll crush the Nationalists as his first act as Emperor. Delgos will fall soon after.
Do we have the troops to take Delgos?
Prelate Crindle, the resident historian, asked.
Turdelfur is defended by a dwarven fortress. It held out against a 2-year siege by the Daka.
I have been working on that very problem, and I think I have a unique solution.
And what might that be?
Galleon asked suspiciously. Luis Guy looked up.
Ah, Archbishop, so good of you to join us. I sent word we were beginning nearly an hour ago.
Do you plan to spank me for being tardy, Guy? Or are you simply trying to avoid my question?
You are not ready to hear the answer to that question,
the sentinel replied, which brought a reproachful look from the Archbishop.
You would not believe me if I told you, and certainly would not approve. But when the time comes, and it is necessary, then rest assured the fortress of Drummondor will fall, and Delgos along with it.
The Archbishop frowned at the slight, but before he could comment, Soldo spoke up.
What about the common people? Will they embrace a new emperor?
He asked.
I have travelled the length and breadth of the four nations promoting the contest. Heralds have announced it from Dagestan in the south to Langstir in the north. All of Apelodorn is aware of the event. In the marketplaces, taverns, and castle courts, anticipation is high. Once we announce the true intent of the contest, the people will be beside themselves. Gentlemen, these are exciting times. It is no longer a question of if, but when the new empire will rise. The groundwork is laid. All we need do is bestow the crown.
And King Ethelred of Warwick?
Galleon asked.
Is he on board?
Guy shrugged. He isn't pleased with giving up his throne to become a viceroy, but few of the monarchs are, even those we placed in power. It is amazing how quickly rulers become accustomed to being called Your Majesty. Yet he has been assured that for being the first to take off his crown, he will be first in line in the new order. It is very likely he will assume the role of regent, administering the empire on behalf of Lord Rufus, as the new emperor is away handling any uprisings. I also suggested that he might remain as chief counsel. He appeared satisfied with that.
I still don't like handing over power to Rufus and Ethelred, Soldo said.
We won't be, Galleon assured him. The Church will be in control. They are the faces, but we are the mind. The Church will have a permanent appointee in the palace of the new empire who will be charged with overseeing the construction of the new order.
He looked to Guy.
Did the Patriarch mention this to you?
He did.
And did he say if he would accept this responsibility himself?
Due to his advanced age,
The Patriarch will not be taking on this burden, but will instead select someone from this council who will be empowered to act autonomously on behalf of the entire Church. That person will be appointed co-regent alongside Ethelred, at least for the duration of the reconstruction phase.
"Such a man would be immensely powerful," the Archbishop said.
Saldor could tell from his tone, perhaps everyone could, that he knew it would not be him.
"Would that person be you?"
Guy shook his head. "My task, as my father before me, and his before that, is to find the heir of Navron. The Patriarch has asked me to assist in these matters concerning the immediate establishment of the Empire, which I am happy to do, but I'll not be deterred from my life's goal."
"Who will it be, then?"
"His Holiness has not yet decided. I suspect he will wait to see how events with the contest play out."
There was a pause as they waited for Guy to speak again.
"This is a historic moment. All that we have worked for, all that has been carefully nurtured for centuries, is about to bear fruit. We now stand at the threshold of a new dawn for mankind. What began nearly a millennium ago will conclude with this generation. May Navron bless our hands."
"He is impressive," Saldor told Galleon.
"You think so?" the Archbishop replied. "Good, because you're coming with us."
"To the contest?"
He nodded.
"I need someone to counterbalance Guy. Perhaps you can be just as big a pain to him as you've been to me."
Arista hesitated outside the door, holding a single candle. Inside, she could hear Bernice shuffling about, turning down the bed, pouring water into the basin, laying out Arista's bedclothes in that ghastly nursemaid way of hers. As tired as she was, Arista had no desire to open that door. She had too much to think about and couldn't bear Bernice just now.
How many days?
She tried counting them in her head, ticking them off, tracking her memories of those muddled times between the death of her father and the death of her uncle. So much had happened so quickly. She still remembered the pale, white look of her father's face as he lay on the bed, a single tear of blood on his cheek, and the dark stain spreading across the mattress beneath him. Arista glanced awkwardly at Hilfred, who stood behind her.
"I'm not ready to go to bed yet."
"As you wish, my lady," he said quietly, as if understanding her need not to alert the nurse-beast within. Arista began walking aimlessly. She travelled down the hallway. This simple act gave her a sense of control, of heading towards something instead of being swept along. Hilfred followed 3 paces behind, his sword clapping against his thigh, a sound she had heard for years, like the swing of a pendulum ticking off the seconds of her life.
How many days?
Sawley had known Uncle Percy would kill her father. He knew before it happened.
How long in advance did he know? Was it hours? Days? Weeks?
He said he had tried to stop him.
That was a lie. It had to be.
Why not expose him? Why not just tell her father?
But maybe Sawley had.
Maybe her father had refused to listen.
Was it possible Ezra Harden really had used her?
The dimly lit hall curved as it circled around the tower. The lack of decoration surprised Arista. Of course, the Crown Tower was only a small part of the old palace, a mere corner staircase. The stones were old hewn blocks, set in place centuries earlier. They all looked the same, dingy, soot-covered and yellow like old teeth. She passed several doors,
then came to a staircase and began climbing. It felt good to exert her legs after being idle so long. How many days? She remembered her uncle searching for Ulrich, watching her, having her followed. If Soldier had known about Percy, why had he not intervened? Why had he allowed her to be locked in the tower and put through that dreadful trial? Would Sawley have allowed them to execute her? If he had just spoken up, if he had backed her, she could have called for Braga's imprisonment. The Battle of Medford could have been avoided, and all those people would still be alive. How many days before Braga's death did Soldon know, and do nothing? It was a question without an answer. A question that echoed in her head. A question she wasn't certain she wanted answered. And what was all this about the destruction of humanity? She knew they thought she was naive.
Do they think I'm ignorant as well?
No one person had the power to enslave an entire race. Not to mention the very idea that this threat emanated from the Emperor was absurd. The man had already been the ruler of the world. The stairs ended in a dark, circular room. No sconces, torches, nor lanterns burned. Her little candle was the only source of illumination. Followed by Hilfred, Arista exited the stairs. They had entered the alabaster crown near the tower's pinnacle. An immediate sense of unease washed over her. She felt like a trespasser on forbidden grounds. There was nothing to give her that impression, except, perhaps, the darkness. Still, it felt like exploring an attic as a child. The silence, the shadowy suggestion of hidden treasures lost to time. Like everyone, she had grown up hearing the tales of Glenmorgan's treasures and how they lay hidden at the top of the Crown Tower. She even knew the story about how they had been stolen yet returned the following night. There were many stories about the tower, tales of famous people imprisoned at its top. Heretics like Edmund Hall, who had supposedly discovered the entrance to the holy city Persepolis and paid by spending the remainder of his life sealed away, isolated, where he could tell no one of its secrets.
It was here. It was all here.
She walked the circle of the room. The sounds of her footsteps echoed sharply off the stone, perhaps because of the low ceiling, or maybe it was just her imagination. She held up her candle and found a door at the far side. It was an odd door. Tall and broad, not made of wood as the others in the tower, nor was it made of steel or iron. This door was made of stone, one single solid block that looked like granite and appeared out of place beside the walls of polished alabaster. She looked at it, perplexed. There was no latch, knob, or hinges, nothing to open it with. She considered knocking.
What good would it do to knock on granite, except to bloody my knuckles?
Placing her hand on the door, she pushed, but nothing happened. Arista glanced at Hilfred, who stood silently watching her.
I just wanted to see the view from the top, she told him, imagining what he might be thinking. She heard something just then. A shuffle. A step from above. Tilting her head, she lifted the candle.
Cobwebs lined the underside of the ceiling, which was made of wood. Clearly someone or something was up there.
Edmund Hall's ghost!
The idea flashed through her mind, and she shook her head at her foolishness. Perhaps she should go and cower in bed and have Auntie Bernice read her a nice bedtime story. Still, she had to wonder, what lay behind that very solid-looking door?
Hello?
A voice echoed, and she jumped. From below, Arista saw the glow of another light rising, the sound of steps climbing.
Is someone up here?
She had an instant desire to hide, and she might have tried if there had been anything to hide behind, and Hilfred had not been with her.
Who's there?
A head appeared, coming around the curve of the steps from below. It was a man, a priest of some sort by the look of him. He wore a black robe with a purple ribbon that hung down from either side of his neck. His hair was thin, and from that angle Arista could see the beginning of a bald spot on the back of his head, a tanned island in a sea of graying hair. He held a lantern above his head and squinted at her, looking puzzled.
"Who are you?"
he asked in a neutral tone. It was neither threatening nor welcoming, merely curious. She smiled, self-consciously.
"My name is Arista. Arista from Melengar."
"Arista from Melengar," he said thoughtfully. "Might I ask what you are doing here, Arista from Melengar?"
"Honestly? I was, hoping to get to the top of the tower to see the view. It's my first time here."
The priest smiled and began to chuckle.
"You are sightseeing, then?"
"Yes, I suppose so."
"And the gentleman with you, is he also sightseeing?"
"He's my bodyguard."
"Bodyguard?"
The man paused in his approach.
"Do all young women from Melengar have such protection when they travel abroad?"
"I am the princess of Melengar, daughter of the late King Amrath and sister of King Alaric."
"Aha!" the priest said, entering the room and walking the curve toward them. "I thought so. You were part of the caravan that arrived this evening, the lady who came in with the Bishop of Medford." "I saw the royal carriage, but didn't know what royalty it contained."
"And you are?" she asked.
"Oh yes, I am very sorry. I am Monsignor Merton of Ghent, born and raised right down below us in a small village called Iberton, a stone's throw from Ervenon. Wonderful fishing in Iberton. My father was a fisherman, by the way. We fished year-round, nets in the summer and hooks in the winter. Teach a man to fish, and he'll never go hungry, I always say. I suppose, in a way, that's how I came to be here, if you get my meaning."
Arista smiled politely and glanced back at the stone door.
"I'm sorry, but that door doesn't go to the outside, and I'm afraid you can't get to the top."
He tilted his head toward the ceiling and lowered his voice.
"That's where he lives."
"He?"
"His Holiness Patriarch Nilnerve. The top floor of this tower is his sanctuary. I come up here sometimes to just sit and listen. When it's quiet, when the wind is still, you can sometimes hear him moving about. I once thought I heard him speak, but that might have just been hopeful ears. It is as if Navron himself is up there right now, looking down, watching out for us. Still, if you like, I do know where you can get a good view. Come with me."
The Monsignor turned and descended back down the stairs. Arista looked one last time at the door, then followed.
"When does he come out?" Arista asked. "The Patriarch, I mean."
"He doesn't. At least not that I have ever seen. He lives his life in isolation, better to be one with the Lord."
"If he never comes out, how do you know he's really up there?"
"Hmm?"
Merton glanced back at her and chuckled.
"Oh, well, he does speak with people. He holds private meetings with certain individuals who bring his words to the rest of us."
"And who are these people? The Archbishop?"
"Sometimes, though lately his decrees have come down to us by way of the Sentinels."
He paused in their downward trek and turned to look at her.
"You know about them, I assume."
"Yes," she told him.
Being a princess, I thought you might.
We actually haven't had one visit Melengar for several years.
That's understandable. There are only a few left, and they have a very wide area to cover.
Why so few?
His Holiness hasn't appointed any new ones, not since he ordained Louis Guy. I believe he was the last.
This was the first good news Arista had heard all day. The sentinels were notorious watchdogs of the church. Originally charged with the task of finding the lost heir, they commanded the famous Order of the Ceret Knights. These knights enforced the church's will, policing layman and clergy alike for any signs of heresy. When the Ceret investigated, it was certain someone would be found guilty, and usually anyone who protested would find themselves charged as well. Monsignor Merton led her to a door 2 floors down and knocked.
"What is it?"
an irritated voice asked.
"We've come to see your view," Merton replied.
"I don't have time for you today, Merton. Go bother someone else or leave me be."
"It's not for me. The Princess Arista of Medford is here, and she wants to see a view from the tower."
"Oh, no, really," Arista told him, shaking her head. "It's not that important. I just..."
The door popped open, and behind it stood a fat man without a single hair on his head. He was dressed all in red, with a gold braided cord around his large waist. He was wiping his greasy hands on a towel and peering at Arista intently.
"By Mar, it is a princess!"
"Janison," Merton snapped. "Please, that's no way for a prelate of the church to speak."
The fat man scowled at Merton.
"Do you see how he treats me? He thinks I'm Uberlin himself because I like to eat and enjoy an occasional drink."
"It is not I that judges you, but our Lord Novron. May we enter?"
"Yes, yes, of course, come in."
The room was a mess of clothes, parchments, and paintings that lay on the floor or leaned on baskets and chests. A desk stood at one end and a large, flat, tilted table was at the other. On it were stacks of maps, ink bottles, and dozens of quills. Nothing appeared to be in its place, or even to have one.
"Oh," Arista nearly said, "dear," but stopped short, realizing she'd almost imitated Bernice.
"Yes, it is quite the sight, isn't it? Prelate Janison is less than tidy."
"I am neat in my maps, and that's all that matters."
"Not to Novron."
"You see? And, of course, I can't retaliate. How can anyone hope to compete with His Holiness Monsignor Merton, who heals the sick and speaks to God?"
Arista, who was following Merton across the wretched room toward a curtain-lined wall, paused as a memory from her childhood surfaced. Looking at Merton, she recalled it.
"You're the savior of Fallon Mire?"
"Aha! Of course he didn't tell you. It would be too prideful to admit he's the chosen one of our Lord."
"Oh, stop that."
It was Merton's turn to scowl.
"Was it you?" she asked.
Merton nodded, sending Janison a harsh stare.
"I heard all about it. It was some years ago. I was probably only 5 or 6 when the plague came to Fallon Mire. Everyone was afraid because it was working its way up from the south, and Fallon Mire was not very far from Medford. I remember my father spoke of moving the court to Drondel Fields, only we never did. We didn't have to, because the plague never moved north of there."
"Because he stopped it," Janison said.
"I did not," Merton snapped. "Novron did."
"But he sent you there, didn't he? Didn't he?"
Merton sighed.
"I only did what the Lord asked of me."
Janison looked at Arista.
"You see? How can I hope to compete with a man whom God himself has chosen to hold daily conversations with?"
"You actually heard the voice of Novron telling you to go save the people of Fallon Mire?"
"He directed my footsteps."
"But you talked to him too,"
Janison pressed, looking at Arista. He won't admit that, of course. Saying so would be heresy, and Luis Guy is just downstairs. He doesn't care about your miracle.
Jennison sat down on a stool and chuckled.
No, the good Monsignor here won't admit that he holds little conversations with the Lord, but he does. I've heard him. Late at night, in the halls, when he thinks everyone else is asleep.
Jennison raised his voice an octave, as if imitating a young girl.
Oh, Lord, why is it you keep me awake with this headache when I have work in the morning? What's that? Oh, I see. How wise of you.
That's enough, Jennison, Merton said, his voice serious. Yes, I'm certain it is, Monsignor. Now take your view and leave me to my meal.
Jennison picked up a chicken leg and resumed eating, while Merton threw open the drapes to reveal a magnificent window. It was huge, nearly the width of the room, divided only by three stone pillars. The view was breathtaking. The large moon revealed the night as if it were a lamp one could reach out and touch, hanging among a scattering of brilliant stars. Arista placed a hand on the windowsill and peered down. She could see the twisting silver line of a river far below, shimmering in the moonlight. At the base of the tower, campfires encircled the city, tiny flickering pinpricks like stars themselves. Looking straight down, she felt dizzy, and her heartbeat quickened. Wondering how close she was to the top of the tower, she looked up and counted three more levels of windows above her, to the alabaster crown of white.
"Thank you,"
she told Merton, and nodded toward Jennison. "Rest assured, Your Highness, he is up there." She nodded, but wasn't certain if he was referring to God or the Patriarch. Chapter 4 Dahlgren. For 5 days, Royce, Hadrian, and Thrace made their way north through the nameless sea of trees that made up the eastern edge of Avron, a region disputed by both Alburn and Dunmore. Each laid claim to the vast, dense forest between them, but until the establishment of Dahlgren, neither appeared in any hurry to settle the land. The Great Forest, referred to merely as either the East or the Wastes, remained uncut, untouched, unblemished. The road they travelled, once a broad lane as it had ploughed north out of Alburn, quickly became two tracks divided by a line of grass, and finally squeezed down to a single dirt trail that threatened to vanish entirely. No fences, farms, nor wayside inns broke the woodland walls, nor did travellers cross their path. Here in the northeast, maps were vague, with few markings, and went entirely blank past the Nidwalden River. At times the beauty of the forest was breathtaking, even spiritual. Monolithic elms towered overhead, weaving a lofty tunnel of green. It reminded Hadrian of the few times he had poked his head into Mayor's Cathedral in Medford. The long-trunked trees arched over the trail like the buttresses of the great church, forming a natural nave. Delicate shafts of muted light pierced the canopy at angles, as if entering through a gallery of windows far above. Along the ground, fans of finely fingered ferns grew up from the past year's brown leaves, creating a soft, swaying carpet. A choir of birds sang in the unseen heights, and from the bed of brittle leaves came the rustle of squirrels and chipmunks like the coughs, whispers, and shifts of a congregation. It was beautiful, yet disturbing, like swimming out too far, delving into unknown, unseen, and untamed places. Over the last days, travel became increasingly difficult. The recent spring storms had dropped several trees across the trail, which blocked the route as formidably as any castle gate. They dismounted and struggled through the thick brush as Royce searched for a way round. Hours passed,
yet they failed to rejoin the road. Scratched and sweaty, they led their horses across several small rivers and on one occasion faced a sharp drop.